This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hi, this is John with some hot news from our sponsor, JetBrains. Their geeky, keyboard-centric bug tracker, UTrack, is now available as a hosted service. You get unlimited projects, 50 user accounts, and all product upgrades, and no installation fuss. That and much more, and you get no costs until July. To register your hosted UTrack installation, go to jetbrains.com/UTrack.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on the 2nd of February / the 3rd of February for Mark Rendell, because he is over in the UK. Mark is a senior software architect at .NET Solutions London, and he is up at 4:30 a.m. to talk to us. Mark, can you just jump right in by telling us about simple.data? Or is it simple data or simple.data? Is the dot pronounced?
I tend to say the dot.
Okay.
Which is possibly just because I haven't got bored of saying it yet. But yeah, simple.data is it's my data access project. The elevator pitch is it's an ORM, but you don't necessarily need objects, you don't necessarily need a relational database, and there's no mapping. So it's like an ORM without the O, the R, or the M.
Right.
So yeah, and it's it kind of came up in response to middle of last year. Microsoft.data kind of hit the blogs and Twitter went mental over it, just going, ah, that's terrible, that's the worst thing ever, SQL injection attacks and so on.
Right.
And so I went off to see if I could code up something similar but without the danger points. And originally it was literally just kind of, look, why don't you do it like this? This would be much better. And then someone went, oh, I downloaded that and used it and I've got my site running on it. And so I thought, fine, I'll go off and actually turn it into a full project. And so here we are. I actually spoke to that guy last week and he said the site's been running on it since that time last year, and he checked the exception ear logs the other day, and that original code hasn't thrown any exceptions in 5 months, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's become a supported thing, and I'm just kind of ready to push it out there and hopefully get more people using it.
So the first thing I noticed about it was that you've really jumped in with using the dynamic property in or dynamic keyword, the dynamic type,
yeah.
I guess,
yeah.
In
yeah.
.NET 4. So pretty much everything's dynamic. And so that lets you do things like, say, db.stock.update by product ID.
Yeah, and yeah, totally.
So no strings at all. It's just all dynamic types.
Yeah. I mean, the inspiration for that comes from Ruby and particularly the Active Record mapping library. And Ruby has this thing called method missing. So when you define a class, you can sort of define a bunch of properties and methods on it. And then you can say method missing and take the name of a method and so forth. And then anytime someone calls a method on that class that it doesn't have, it'll drop into this method missing function and just go, well, can I do something with it anyway? And so the dynamic features in .NET 4 and C# have something similar where they have a dynamic object base class that you can derive from, and that gives you overrides for methods and properties and all sorts of other things. And yeah, you can just kind of say someone has called find by ID, and therefore I can pull apart that find by ID method and all the information that I get about the call and turn that into something useful, which is kind of the dynamic equivalent of the link expression thing. So, you know, link to SQL or link to entity framework or whatever will take a big long string of dot wheres and dot selects and dot order bys and turn that into something that is converted into SQL at runtime. So with simple data, I'm just doing that, but with dynamic calls. And saying, you know, I see that you've passed in named arguments called this, that, and the other. So I can use those as parameter names when I'm calling a store procedure or column names when I'm generating an insert statement.
So that whole, you know, the method missing application here, I've heard people talk about that, but this is actually the first thing that really kind of jumped at me as, you know, something really built out that completely bought into that. And I guess no surprise that that's, you know, implementing an active record pattern. But so I was looking, you know, at the code, and it looks like you've got, there's data strategy, which extends dynamic object, and then you've got try get member, and then that's where you do the dynamic lookup and figure out how to bind to the object, right?
Yeah, that's right. So data strategy, that actually went in fairly recently because someone said, how can I do transactions? So you can start a transaction by saying db.beginTransaction, and that will return you a transaction object. And then you can carry on using that in exactly the same way as you would use a database object. But all the operations you do against the transaction are within that transaction, and then you can commit and it's finished with. But both of those are sharing the data strategy functionality, which is where the method calls and parameter lists and so on are actually pulled apart and turned into dictionaries and SQL or whatever else. So that's all data strategy is. It was the database inherited directly from dynamic object, as did table and various other little bits and pieces that make it work. But once I introduced transactions, it was kind of, well, a transaction and a database are both different ways of doing an insert. So I'm going to derive things up into this base data strategy class.
Okay. So I guess kind of the flow of how this was built up, you started with the simple like CRUD, the insert, update, delete, read.
Yeah.
And then from there, you were talking, you've just recently put in transactions. What are some other things along the way that you've added in building this out?
Okay, so first release had had the insert, update, delete, and find methods, and it also had an extra feature where if you accessed a property on one of the dynamic records that's returned, and it couldn't resolve that as being one of the column names from the underlying table, then it would go, well, can I resolve that as being a table name that I can make sense of in terms of referential integrity on the database? So if you've got like customer and there's an orders table and there's a link between those in foreign keys and primary keys, then it would go off and actually resolve that for you and pull back all the orders for that customer. And so that was all in the first release. So you could actually say db.customers.findbyid1.orders, and it would pull you back an enumerable of dynamics of the order records for that customer, in a select n plus one kind of way that drives DBAs mad.
Right. Well, yeah, I guess we should get back to that, because I, you know, that's always, or maybe I could ask now. I was talking to Rob Connery about this kind of thing last night, and he was saying gone back to just, he loves SQL. He's like, you know, if you just write raw SQL, you're never going to go wrong. Obviously, one of the motivations for doing this was that you were noticing SQL injection is common pitfall if you're just writing out straight strings. But what are some, I don't know, how do you balance that with the, you know, writing SQL and the problems there versus writing out the, you know, generating SQL and potentially the select n plus one and all those other pitfalls there?
Okay, so one of the other things that's gone in into the, which is in the 0.4 release, which was kind of the thing that I got in there and then thought, actually, now you can use this. This is something sensible, is the ability to call store procedures if you're working against SQL Server full-blown edition. And so the DBA can come along and write a store procedure and say, I want it to use this to get around these problems. So, yeah, hopefully that, for people who do want to write the SQL themselves, will be a good way of handling that.
So you just write db dot and then the stored procedure name, and it'll execute it and return something.
Yeah, it'll return a result set or multiple result sets, and it will actually handle input output parameters, and you'll be able to get the return value back as well. So yeah, the thing is with sort of SQL and whatever else is going on, there's kind of, we say sort of SQL injection, and you kind of think of it as something that it's a bit of a pain in the whatever to deal with SQL injection, because you have to create all these parameters and all this sort of stuff. But I think those of us who care about the way we write our code and try to write sort of good code just as a matter of course, and also who know what good code looks like, kind of think that SQL injection everyone knows about it, everyone codes against it, and so forth. But I was on Stack Overflow on Monday, and someone was on there asking a question about his select statement, which was returning some things he wasn't expecting, but he posted the code. And he had, you know, he was building up his where clause by concatenating in text box values. And it was just kind of, you know, people on Stack Overflow going, never mind what's actually going wrong here, can we just talk about SQL injection attacks? And so there are lots and lots of people out there who just don't have this knowledge that this thing is even a problem, and are happily coding along and letting it happen to them. And so one of the things I was trying to do with Simple Data is go, okay, let's get these guys who don't know this stuff and just make it impossible for them to do that with their SQL, and at the same time see if I can make it really easy for them to write database access code. So these are guys for whom select n plus 1 is a problem that they're going to have way down the street. And if we can get them to the point where they get there without someone dropping their database, then let's do that, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So, and I apologize, I cut you off because I couldn't, I knew I would forget if I didn't. So okay. I was having you talk through kind of the progression. Had you gone through enough of that you were happy, or you know, like the grand history of Simple Data?
There's kind of the one thing that happened in between that initial release and the adding store procedures was I added a facility where you could use more complex query operators, because obviously find by and find all by, it's just going where these things are equal to these things. And so I had a look to see if I could find a way of doing nice readable greater than and less than and things like that, and came up with an interesting solution where it uses operator overloading and then returns expressions back from that. And so if you say db.users.firstname.like something and or, you know, the ampersand db.users.joinDate is greater than dateTime.something, then it will actually return you an expression. It'll convert that into an expression and then run that against the database. So you can express more complicated queries. And then within that as well, it will handle natural joins. So if you can say db.customers.orders.orderItems.item.name equals widget, and it will go off and construct all those joins for you as part of the query. So yeah, it's that, as long as you've got the referential integrity set up in the database, it's extremely good at working out these things for you. And with db.users.findByEmailAndPassword, you've got one thing going on where you've basically removed the cruft of using SQL connection equals this and using SQL command equals that, and then set up the command and then using SQL data reader equals and so forth. So you've got the kind of the boilerplate code that goes along with every single query. But then with the natural join inference, which is something that SQL Server still can't do, it's actually taking out quite a lot of boilerplate SQL as well, which I think tidies the code up a lot, particularly in a smaller project where you may not have a defined data access layer. Mm-hmm. And you're keeping your query code in the same place as everything else. The plan is to try and reduce the amount of just the same code over and over again, which affects a lot of these things, but without needing the heavyweight approach of using an ORM like nHibernate or Entity Framework or Subsonic or something.
Right. Now, you support a list of databases. How many databases do you support?
In the release that's gone up to NuGet recently, which is 0.45, it supports SQL Server. It's tested against back to 2005, so 2008 and 2008 R2. I can't see any reason why it wouldn't work against 2000, except I think I am using a sys.columns query in one place. And it also supports SQL Compact 4.0. It was supporting SQL Compact 3.5, and then when 4.0 went RTW, I kind of got into supporting the two things side by side, and then there were a couple of things in 4.0 it simplified the code there, and I was thinking, you know, do people really want the 3.5 now that 4's out? Mm-hmm. So I'm just supporting 4. But for people who want other databases, there's a couple of layers of abstraction underneath Simple Data, which will allow them to add those in really, really easily, I hope. So, I mean, at the moment, those are the ones that are supported. What I really am looking to do over the next couple of months is support particularly the open source databases, and hopefully get this running on Mono 2.8 or 2.10, which supports the dynamic features that it uses. So maybe get MySQL support and PostgreSQL and SQLite. And then looking beyond that, it has actually no need at all to work with, it doesn't need a relational database. It'll work with NoSQL databases. I did a very quick spike, which I haven't put up anywhere because it's quite dangerous, but you can actually run queries against the registry using the same syntax, which is interesting.
Yeah.
and I wouldn't recommend it. But yeah, again, going back to Ruby, the adapter pattern that I'm using, I've actually borrowed from DataMapper, which is the other big Ruby ORM, in that everything that's passed backwards and forwards. So Simple Data takes the queries from your application and then expresses them using its internal types, passes them through to the adapter, and the adapter just chucks dictionaries of string, comma, object back up, and then Simple Data turns those into dynamic types and pushes them back up again. So anything that you can query against and give me dictionaries back, I can say, okay, we can do find by this and inserts and updates against this, and kind of mediate between the two.
Cool. And I notice that you're using Meph there for creating the adapters.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that working well for you?
It is. I have had a couple of people kind of get in touch with me and say, when I try and run this off a network drive, I get issues, because obviously Meph with directory catalogs, it's trying to access the file system. But I think you generally shouldn't be running these things off network drives anyway. So, but yeah, Meph, I'm a huge fan of Meph. And I use it for a lot of stuff where, you know, potentially I should be using like a proper IOC container like AutoFac or StructureMap or whatever. But actually Meph does a really good job for the majority of cases, and it's lightweight and it's actually built in to .NET 4. So I'm not adding extra dependencies to the project just to achieve this fairly simple thing of saying, you know, I need a type and it needs to have this contract, and I don't really care beyond that. So yeah, Meph's working really well for that at the moment and for lots of other things that I'm working on.
So I was looking over some of the tests in the project, and and I noticed that most of your, I think all of your find tests go by a single clause. And I was wondering if you were going to support multiple clauses and how you were going to handle grouping and operator precedence.
Okay.
Not to completely creep the scope on you, but...
No, it copes with operator precedence and everything. Where are we? SQL test and SQL CE40 test are kind of, they're using NUnit, but they are in no way unit tests. They have dependencies. Dependencies which drive me nuts, because I do some work on this on my work PC, where we have to follow the company database server naming conventions, and then the rest of it on my laptop, where it's just dot. And so every time I do a get on one of them or a pull from GitHub on one of them and run the tests, it complains all the SQL tests fail because it can't connect to the database. But no, there are a bunch of tests, and I'm just looking to find out where they are. So we've got natural join test, for example, but the expression syntax that I mentioned, where it combines, it overrides operators. So it overrides all the equality and inequality operators on the dynamic reference type. And then rather than returning true or false, it returns an expression. And then those expressions override the logical and or operators and return other expressions, which and or them together. And in terms of operator precedence, I wrote some tests and I crossed my fingers and I thought let's just see if the C# compiler and whatever will do this for me. And it did. So you just kind of do the ands and the ors and put parentheses around things.
Yeah, that was what I was most curious about, because, you know, if say you got three clauses and you put parentheses around the first two, it has a much different meaning than if you don't have any parentheses at all. So you've got and two ors or something in there. And that's why I was kind of curious to see how you were handling it. Because I tried writing one back in 10 years ago, and that was the thing that was the hardest, was trying to guess kind of the SQL syntax and how things should be grouped and build I was building a UI for people to do ad hoc queries, but that was kind of the hardest thing.
It's one of those things that if I'd had to kind of do it in any other way except using the dynamic features and this expression stuff, it would have thrown me completely. I don't know if you've got the code there, but if you go into the unit test project, there's a simple expression test class in there which has got really good examples of how the grouping and prioritization goes. And actually, when I first got this up and running, it wasn't using the double ampersand and the double pipe operators. It was using the bitwise versions, because when I tried to use the double ampersand and the double pipe, the compiler started complaining at me. And I was complaining on Twitter about this one day, and John Skeet went, "Oh, if you overload the bool operator as well, then or the true and false operators on the expressions, then you'll be able to use the and the or operators." And so I switched that in, and that worked. So that's the simple expression test class has got good examples of how that works. And there is a class in there somewhere which I can't for the life of me find, because there are so many tests, because I'm so good and do things properly.
I was impressed. There were lots and lots of tests, and they weren't
this has been test driven. It's the first project I've done where every single feature in there has been driven out by tests. And you know, you try to do this with as many projects as possible, but because it started out with just kind of, is this possible? So that lends itself to being test driven. And then once I'd got to the point where CRUD operations were supported and a couple of other things were supported, just every time I changed something, I would actually rerun all the tests and just go, have I broken anything? And sometimes I had, and I'd fix it. And so now it's just, it's fear-driven development. I am terrified that any change I make is going to break other stuff. And so I'm trying to maintain as much test coverage as possible so that I can be reasonably sure when I push a new version up to NuGet that I'm not going to be breaking a bunch of people's code. But yeah, this is the breakthrough project for me and unit testing and test-driven development, really, to the point where now I just don't think I could have written this in any other way. And when I download other people's sort of spike code or POC code or whatever, and they haven't got any tests, I'm just kind of like, how are you doing this?
That was one of the reasons that I looked at the test first, was because I knew that, you know, if I just went and looked at the classes, that, you know, it would just look like, you know, gobbledygook to me, because I've never seen it before and I haven't really worked with dynamic that much. But I thought, well, if I can read the tests, I can see how it's supposed to all be used.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I could.
Yeah. Well, the guy who used it that first time, like I say, he did it by looking at the very early version of the what's now called the behavior tests, but was at the time called integration tests. And that had all the operations he needed in there, and it showed if you put this in and call this method, then this is the SQL that should be generated. And so that's a really easy way, if you just go through the database test class, to see what things are doing in there. And actually, what I will probably do after we've finished here is add a few more tests to that database test thing, just to bring it up to date, and kind of keep more of these tests in one place, and then flag that up as still being the best place to go to get an understanding of the project.
Did you find that the heavy use of dynamics sort of mandated, you know, that the heavy testing, that not having that compiler crutch to fall back on, really just pushed you in, you know, whole hog?
Not really, because the code I'm writing isn't dynamic at all. The code I'm writing is all statically typed. It's working around dictionaries, and it's working with kind of a specific set of overrides on the dynamic object type. And then, you know, when you get into the adapter class, and actually the ADO adapter is where a lot of the complexity is hiding these days. It's all strongly typed stuff. So the tests are nearly all making sure that code that users of the simple data library would write is going to work correctly. There's stuff in the unit test project that just makes sure various bits and pieces that I've written work in standalone. But no, there is this perception, I think, that comes up quite a lot in debates about testing and debates between people who prefer a statically typed language and environment to a dynamically typed environment, where people say the dynamically typed guys are the Ruby guys particularly and the Python guys. The reason they have to write so many tests is because they don't have static typing. And actually, I've done quite a lot of Ruby coding, and you can't really write tests which replace static typing for you, because the point at which that static versus dynamic typing is, am I passing the right thing into this method here? As I'm chucking my values around, my objects around, are they being the right type? And when you're writing unit tests, you tend to be testing at the method level. And so if the test, all you can really do is say, if I throw the wrong thing in, is this going to fail in a useful and meaningful way? So you don't see many tests that are there as a crutch because they don't have static typing and they don't have compilation time type checking. I've been doing a presentation about using the dynamic features of C# 4 in various creative ways. And I cover this kind of debate between static typing and dynamic typing in there. And my conclusion as to why people from statically typed environments don't like dynamic typing is because they can't code without IntelliSense. So they've kind of got themselves to this point where they type something and press dot and then wait for a menu of available options. Whereas dynamic guys are kind of having to remember what's going on at all these different points. So it's an IDE thing rather than a compilation or type safety thing a lot of the time. Did that answer the question?
Yes, absolutely.
Fundamentally, the tests are there to make sure that what other people are going to do is going to work. For the most part, the code I've been writing is all very traditional C#, strongly typed stuff. Yeah, God knows if I could have written this in Ruby or anything like that. There's some complicated stuff in there. It's very weird, actually. It's kind of talking about looking at the code and it's incredibly complex and so forth. And I look at the code as it is now and I just go, oh my God, it's just really very, very intricate. And there's lots of types in there. And I've tried to keep it as clean and as solid and as dry and everything as possible. But the way it grew organically and incrementally, actually, none of the code that I wrote at the time and none of the changes that I made were particularly complicated. It's amazing how fast a project goes from a quick spike and you can kind of read through the code and see what it's up to something where it's really hard to try and just stick something in it and get a hold on where it's doing things. So that may be something I need to address if I ever want anybody else to contribute anything to this project or help me look after it.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that the code wasn't well structured or not dry. It was just that I knew that given the type of code that it was going to be, ORM, very, you know, I never know what's going to be next kind of thing.
Yeah.
Using dynamic typing and method missing or whatever the equivalent is called in the dynamic type in .NET. That I knew that I'd have to, if you know, to get up to speed to quick on it.
I was just, you go and read other people's code and you know, the thing that Scott Hanselman's kind of really big on, and I try and do that. Certainly anytime someone says, look, I've made this and it's new and it's great, then I'll go and I'll download the code and I'll have a look through it. And I've always been in awe of these people who wrote this incredibly complicated looking code, and I'm just struggling to work out what's going on. And then I wrote this, and I'm kind of going, oh, right, so it's just, it ends up that way. But you, when you get there as an incremental process, it doesn't actually feel that complicated from the inside. But yeah, it's an interesting experience. So yeah, there you go.
Well, and from the roadmap too, with what you're planning for like the 0.6 release with complex queries, it seems like, depending, I mean, at first I was thinking like, man, the code's going to get even crazier, but it seems like with the pattern you've got set up that it just continues in that same way.
Yeah, I mean, actually, a lot of the stuff that's in there is the building blocks to satisfy this internally are already in place. So things like the join, the left join method, that's a minor tweak to the internal joining code that's already there. And then there's some other bits where I've kind of got this concept of formatting expressions. So you take an expression and just go to string, and then it becomes SQL. And so that handles a lot of this stuff as well. And kind of aliasing, there's already, I know where that's going to go, and it's just adding an extra property to the simple reference type to say, you know, this has got an alias, call it that instead. So yes, it's not actually going to be a big jump to get to that point. And also, one of the things that this is going to allow, going back to the select n plus one, is that actually I have this idea that if you say, okay, do this query to get an employee record out, and then on the query reference a child table of employee, then it will, rather than run that query, get the primary key out and then run the child table query, it will just create a new query which includes the existing query as criteria and then combines in the child table. And so you actually get past that select n plus one. It doesn't need to pull back the parent record in order to pull back the child records. So that will get around that. And then at that point, I will probably show my face at SQL conferences and go, hey, look at this.
Well, yeah, I was gonna ask about that as kind of like a next thing. It's like eventually people start, I mean, when you've got something that people are actually going to seriously use in production as they already are, then people start really caring about the performance. And I guess the two sides of the performance, one is the generated SQL and how well does that work? And then two is the, you know, just, you know, the actual code. And especially, you know, with use of dynamic types and all this, you know, MEF lookup and all that kind of stuff, I could, unless you're doing a good amount of caching, it would seem like that can get kind of slow.
There is there's a good amount of caching, and there's some more caching going in, but that's going to be post 0.6. So basically in my roadmap, and I'm starting to look at that and go, late February, really? But the thing between 0.6 and 1.0 is going to be some aggressive caching and things, and I'm putting some of that in already. So yeah, the dynamic resolution and so forth is something I've done quite a lot of performance tests and profiling. And if you run something 10,000 times in a loop, then the dynamic overhead will add a noticeable amount of time. But if you are running something once, or, you know, 10,000 times over the course of a day on a web server, then it really doesn't add a huge amount of overhead. And there are actually some things in the ADO adapter and in the plumbing code which probably compensate for that in ways that will make up for some of the dynamic overhead. One thing that I am particularly pleased with is, obviously, if you pull a bunch of records from a database and using a SQL data reader, and then you want to return that as an enumerable. If you're doing yield return, then you'll actually drop out of your using statement and the data reader gets disposed, which I found out very early on. And so you have to kind of write different disposing code at the adapter end. But the other thing is, When someone is for-reaching through an enumerable, they aren't really thinking about where that enumerable's come from and what's driving it at the back end. And so they won't necessarily be treating it like a database connection. And if you've got a web server and you've got a whole bunch of people hitting against your database, you don't want to be holding open connections any longer than you have to, because there's a limited number of them. And so what the ADO adapter for simple.data does is it pushes the records that it's finding through an observable, and then that simple data turns that back into an enumerable. And it actually uses the reactive extensions, which is the only dependency project that it's got. So if you install simple data from NuGet, you'll see that it installs the reactive extensions from what was DevLabs.
That was supposed to be my smart guy question, was, hey, I noticed when I installed via NuGet, I got the reactive extensions. But yeah.
Okay, so yeah. I was looking at a way to say, okay, how can I get everything out of the database as quickly as possible and close the connection without forcing the people at the other end to do to list and then necessarily have to wait until all the results have been returned before they can carry on with their code. And so this is exactly the sort of thing that reactive extensions is designed for. And reactive extensions has this idea that you have an observable, which is a push pattern. And so the data reader is getting things from the database and pushing them at the observable. And then you can convert that observable to an enumerable, which if you look in the reactive extensions code with Reflector, you can see is actually being done with a concurrent queue. And then people can start pulling at the other end. And so I vaguely thought about sort of implementing this caching thing myself, so as not to have the dependency. And then I thought, you know, this is out there, and this is an awesome library, and it's written by people who are so much smarter than me. And it's on NuGet, which is how I'm going to distribute this. And I think it's on OpenWrap as well, and I want to get simple.data onto OpenWrap. And so why not just use that? But the nice thing about that is, as soon as the first record is returned, you have access to it, even if the database is then pulling back the next 99 records. And at the same time, as soon as all 100 records have been returned, the connection is closed and is available for the next thing to come along and use, even if you're still doing sort of formatting or generating a view from that first record. And it just gets held in memory. So the only issue there, obviously, is if you pull back a million rows, it's going to have a lot of rows sitting around in a queue in memory. But I would say that you shouldn't be pulling back a million rows anyway. And also, if you're at those kind of scale volume levels, then I'm not really sure that simple.data is the right solution for you. And you might want to be looking to have a more what's the word?
Robust.
Mission. Robust, mission critical, bulletproof, mature.
Scalable distributed enterprise.
Yeah. All those things. Right. So, you know, there is nHibernate out there, and there's Entity Framework. And both of those are, you know, the result of dozens of man years of development.
Sure.
And so I certainly won't be using simple.data for everything I do. But at the same time, it's kind of, there's an expanding marketplace. There seems to be this growing movement towards, if I'm just knocking together a very simple website, mm-hmm. then what the hell am I doing using kind of IIS and an ASP.NET and an entity framework or in Hibernate? It's like over in the Ruby world, you got Rails, and Rails is fantastic, and you can do lots of things with Rails, but you've also got Sinatra. And so now we're getting this appearing in .NET, in that you've got kind of ASP.NET web forms and ASP.NET MVC and IIS, but you've also got things like FUBU MVC and OpenRaster and these lightweight frameworks. And we now have our very own Nancy.
Right.
The Sinatra clone. Mm-hmm. And so that's where simple data is really targeted. Oh, and WebMatrix, of course,
yep.
Which the thing that started all of this, which was Microsoft.data, that has now appeared and is in production, and it's the data access tool that goes into WebMatrix. And that's somewhere that I really see simple data being potentially useful. is where you are just putting together a site that's maybe only a dozen pages and you're running it on a .NET SQL Compact 4 database or a SQL Express database, or you know, you're deploying onto AppHarbor or Monkey or one of these new kind of Heroku-style hosting platforms and maybe pushing a SQLite database up there. And so that's where Simple Data is targeted, where you're just taking the lightweight components to put together something that hasn't got all this overhead of masses of generated code and generated classes and mapping configuration files and so forth.
Sure.
And just wants to work on the fly. And if I can cache the commands and so forth that are being generated as we go along, then that will hopefully solve any performance issues.
So that was, I think you pretty much answered it. We had a question from Aaron Stannard, his Twitter handle is Aaron on the web, and he asked what would be a good use case for Simple Data versus something heavier like in Hibernate and looking for a good pivot. So I think what you're saying there is pretty much like with a lot of these simple, lightweight solutions, it's use it until you need the heavier solution pretty much, right?
Yeah, basically. And I mean, so there's Simple Data works without you having any classes at all. Although I should say, actually, that if you've got classes and you try and cast a Simple Data record to a static type, it will do a fairly good job of it for you. But the usefulness of that, that's basically doing what NHibernate Fluent or Fluent NHibernate does, mm-hmm. and also the Entity Framework Code First stuff, where basically you have a bunch of classes and you just talk to Entity Framework as though you had done all the setup, and then it'll just work that out for you on the fly and potentially even create the database for you on the fly. So Simple Data kind of sits in that gap where you don't necessarily want to go to all the trouble of creating classes. You don't need to create a customer class and an order class and an order items class, because you are just creating a very simple little website, and you're not doing model view controller. You're just doing view, you're just doing kind of just a WCF REST, a RESTful architecture, where you're pulling things out and returning very simple data back. And so it kind of sits in there. That said, I've used it on a couple of my company projects. So in terms of mission critical support, I'm certainly confident enough in it to use it for that. So I wouldn't say only use it for trivial, unimportant projects. But
the focus is on kind of the lightweight scenario.
The focus is on lightweight code.
Okay. So I've got two more questions from Twitter, and they're both probably quick because I think we've covered some of them. Jeff Schumacher, Code Reflection on Twitter, asked, will there be support for simple aggregates like sum and count as well as transactions? And we already talked about transactions a bit. What about count and sum and other aggregates?
Those will be going into version 0.6, so that more complicated set where you've got kind of dot select and dot order by, that will also have dot group by, and then you'll be able to sort of select db.users.count or db.employees.salary.sum, mm-hmm. And so on. So I will be providing support for those in there.
Cool. Okay, and then we had a question from Jackson Harper, and he asked, does it support async functions, preferably via events or callbacks? And especially that got me thinking, since you're using reactive extensions under the hood, that's a little bit more of that model there.
Yeah, it's not supporting async specifically yet, although obviously there is that kind of reactive caching thing in there. So as soon as the first record comes back, you get the first record. It's certainly something that I'm looking to do, and maybe expose the observable interface directly, so that you, rather than saying for each in this, just say run this and then call me back when you've got stuff coming through, which is essentially what async boils down to. And then I think when Microsoft kind of come out with their async await and the task based asynchrony, then I will look to see if there's a way that can be integrated. Although the generic stuff, which Task and Func and Action and Expression are based around at the moment, don't like the dynamic keyword. So I'm not sure how much of that's going to be able to go in there.
So I was wondering about whether or not, and it's not my place to say whether you do or not, but whether or not you should support like aggregate functions when they could just as easily, you know, use link to do those kinds of things when they get the result set back. Since you're not really limiting the set when you're using those aggregate functions, you're just doing things on them. I wonder if it would be more efficient or not. Well, not efficient is, you know, if efficient is as efficient does, I guess. But if it would be, you know, I guess easier from the framework point of view to keep it simpler and just say, you know, just you get back a collection, do your collection aggregates on it yourself.
This is becoming more of a struggle as simple data becomes more complicated. Is how complicated do I let it get, and at what point do I kind of go, you know what, no, it doesn't do that. And if you need that, then I highly recommend Fluent and Hibernate, or I highly recommend Entity Framework Code First as your next logical step. I think certainly count is worth implementing, but count might be worth implementing at a kind of higher level. So just doing, rather than having a find, have a count method, which, you know, count by ID or count by this and with the complex criteria, because I think that there is a big advantage sometimes to, rather than selecting back 100 records and then counting them, just being able to go, there are 100 of those. And that's, you know, it keeps DBAs happy and so forth. I think possibly with things like sum and min and max and average, then you may be right. And I guess to a certain extent, I can kind of leave them out. And then if people ask for them, kind of add them in, do the simplest thing that can possibly work, and then respond to requests potentially. So, yeah.
Count is an interesting... sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say count is one that I think is a separate case from the other aggregate functions. I think it's got more broader applicability and a bigger, more obvious benefit as well.
Mm-hmm. It seems like if you're going to be doing smart aggregates that are actually going to execute in the database, you know, and then it would make sense to implement them. But if you're not, you know, if you are just really just iterating through things, and, you know, then I'd agree with Scott that it's almost kind of high, like I would expect as a client that it actually is going to execute in the database. And so,
oh yeah, it would be executing in the database. If I add those in, then it will be executing.
Ah, then to heck with Scott, because I would think performance wise, I'd prefer to be able to call into the server as opposed to iterating through things on the client, right?
Okay, I'll consider that a feature.
We're just bouncing you back and forth.
I was thinking count is kind of a special case, because you could almost make it into a clause or be able to tack a clause onto it. So, and have it construct the SQL differently. And in the case I'm thinking of specifically would be paging.
Yeah.
So you could say, you know, select yada yada, and then, you know, do the dot if count greater than, you know, 10, then do something like enable paging and only have it select the first 10 rows and return a marker row so it knows where it was, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that would be...
That is actually something that I was talking to someone about at the weekend at the DDD event over here, is paging, and the fact that, you know, even if you are just knocking together a page in Web Matrix or one of the Sinatra clones, paging is still something that's very important. So we were talking about ways that you could implement paging in simple.data, and that is the idea of being reactive and just going, this is a big query, I'm going to page it for you, is actually quite a good one. So I will investigate that further. Thank you.
Yeah, so you'd mentioned before kind of the spectrum, you know, you've got the heavier full things where you need a full web server, you need a web stack and all that, down to the Sinatra Nancy level. And so that kind of brings up Owen and then Crack, which you'd worked on recently, which is, you know, good for a whole bunch of laughs. You tell us how you got started with Crack?
Well, I lived on...
When did you first take your first hit of Crack?
Yeah, I lived in the projects, and so like I say, I paddle in the world of Ruby and Sinatra and so forth, and there are things over there that I just kind of think, why haven't we got that? And rack is obviously one of those things. And I think I just tweeted, why haven't we got a rack in .NET? Because I'd done some work on RavenDB, which is AND's document database, where he wants to create an HTTP listener. And I was trying to get this running on Azure, and Azure doesn't have elevated privileges. And if you try and create an HTTP listener without elevated privileges, then it gets very upset and says you can't do that. And so I wrote an extremely straightforward, lightweight TCP version of HTTP listener. And I kind of got interested in the whole HTTP thing at that point. And then Microsoft came along on Azure and went, nah, you've got elevated privileges. And so I just thrown it all away. But the interest in this HTTP and the way that's handled in .NET kind of stuck with me. And just the fact that you can't create an HTTP request object yourself, it's kind of its internal protected constructors and so I was complaining about this on Twitter, and someone went, well, go and look at Owen. That's what this thing is that everyone's talking about. And so I went and looked on the group, and there was this they were talking about what the interface should be. And the thing with .NET and interfaces is if you implement an interface, then you have to have a reference to the assembly in which that interface is defined. So if you have iApplication and iRequestHandler and iResponseHandler and so forth, then there has to be a DLL which contains those, and everyone has to subscribe to that. And then you start to get into versioning, people update it to support something new, and then you've got which version of that are you dealing with and so forth. And so I thought, what if you took a functional approach to this, and rather than saying you have to implement this interface, and the other thing is that these interfaces largely only had one method each, and an interface with one method is just a delegate. And so I broke down this the whole interface structure that Owen was using into three delegates. And because there was Frack, which I assumed was doing something similar in F#, I called it Crack because it was written in C#.
And that was mostly just so you could implement the pipe pattern, right?
Actually, no, it was called Crack. And then I went, oh, I can call these pipes. So it had a test page. I said, this server is running on Crack. And yeah, your middleware was called Crack Pipes, which... And I really liked that, and a couple of other people liked it. I was talking to Glenn Block, and he liked it.
Of course he would, the meth dealer, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what we were talking. He was going, you know, I'm the meth pusher, meth dealer. And so now I had this thing called Crack. But the thing was, I kind of went back onto the Owen mailing list. I was really pleased with what I'd done, because I'd actually created a system where there was a crack.dll, and... you could use it to perform the gluing together of stuff. So you kind of go, okay, here's my TCP based web server, and here's my application, and here's my middleware that does gzip compressing and uncompressing or whatever it is. But equally well, you didn't need that crack.dll. You could write your own thing that pulled these different bits in, and they would still talk to each other. So I'd managed to remove the need for any kind of implementation from Owen. And, you know, this was just me kind of going, look, I've done this, and I think that's a good discussion point. And I went back onto the Owen mailing list and said, I've made this thing, and it's called Crack. And everyone ignored me. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm not getting taken seriously because I called it Crack. And so I renamed it to Fix.
I was wondering, because I was trying to look it up on GitHub, and Fix, yeah, I was so finding it's Fix, but not Crack. So.
Okay, so what was Crack is now Fix. So there's still a drug reference in there.
Wait,
but
what?
It's
there was
less
a drug reference? What are you talking?
Well, you know,
nah,
Fix. So, yeah. The thing is, though... when it was called Crack, you also had Crack Up, which is a much, much tamer little pun. Because mm-hmm. Obviously in Ruby and Rack, you have Rack Up. But now you have Fix Up, which also makes sense. And I went on and I said, look, I've done this. And it helped to drive the discussion, which was the main reason I did it. I also got to do some remote pairing with Glenn Block, who helped me write some more MEF provider code that you can actually go, MEF, give me all the public methods in all the public types, which would match this extremely complicated delegate signature. And MEF goes off and just returns you a bunch of actions or funks that match that signature. So that was really interesting. And it's the first time I'd actually kind of talked to Glenn over Skype as well. And very, very interesting guy, very fun guy to talk to.
Well, so back to when you first went on the list, I don't think people weren't taking you seriously. It was it was that they were kind of set down this path, and we were afraid that if we kept rethinking it, we were going to get into this analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
And initially kind of what you threw out there was kind of, at least to me, I was like, would that even work? And you know, how would you write things though if you can't add a reference? But when I started to see people implementing it, and I looked at it, and I said, but you don't have a reference. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You just, it completely removes that need, so we don't have to ship anything outside of this signature.
Yeah, because this was the other thing is when I first pitched up, I think the big debate about .NET 3.5 versus .NET 4 had just been decided in favor of supporting .NET 3.5 because Seb with OpenRaster and OpenHTTP had a lot of people out there who weren't in a position where they were ready to move to .NET 4. And so again, they both have action delegates and func delegates, and so it removes that layer of abstraction again, and also the whole async thing. You know, there's very little difference between returning a task of T and returning a func of T, and if you want to run that func of T on a background thread, then you've got begin invoke on the delegate, so you can do that. So you don't quite get all the task scheduler goodness that you get in .NET 4, but it is an asynchrony method that will work happily in .NET 3.5. When I kind of pulled this thing apart and went, okay, I now have a DLL which has got an HTTP server in it, and I've got a DLL, two DLLs which have got applications in them, and I've got another DLL which has got middleware in them, and none of those DLLs either have a reference to each other or even a reference to another common DLL, I was just kind of, that's pretty cool. I think that's pretty powerful when you are trying to create a specification rather than create yet another library. But yes, it is one of those things where people who maybe haven't played with lambdas and actions and funks and any kind of functional programming are looking at it and going, how am I going to write stuff for this? But for those people, you can actually create libraries which remove a lot of that complexity, and you can give them an interface to implement if that's what they want. So yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking about the whole Owen kind of model. I think that as far as, you know, a lot of the complexity is going to be in the host and not necessarily in the web frameworks that people are going to build on top of it. I mean, once you get past, you know, the initial, I've got to, you know, this signature has a lot of angle brackets in it. Once you get past that, then, you know, you're like, okay, well, now I've just got this environment and I do things with it.
Yeah. And you're gonna have a very few extremely clever people like Benjamin and Ryan and Seb who are going to write kind of small, powerful, fast web server components and small, powerful web framework components. But 99% of people are just going to come along and download whichever of those is most appropriate for their project, and hopefully simple data as well, and put them all together. And they will never know what it is that Owen consists of, in the same way that most people coming along and creating a Rails app or a Sinatra app don't have the faintest idea what the rack specification looks like, or people creating Django apps don't know what the WSGI specification looks like. They just come along and use a library that someone's made that's built on this foundation. But I do think that Owen is going to open up a whole new space in .NET development, and it's a really, really exciting step forward and step in the right direction, which I have kind of fallen out of again because I've been wrapped up in Simple Data. But I kind of stick my... I'm still on the mailing list, and I kind of see the mails that are going past. So yeah.
Cool.
I've been talking for... ages.
No, this is great. I was worried you'd be half awake and we'd be working really hard to try and get any words out of you, and that's not been a problem, so that's awesome.
I may be asleep. I tend not to stop talking. The mouth keeps going.
Right. Well, we should probably wrap up pretty soon. So any last questions or thoughts or anything, Scott, Kevin? I think Scott has actually drifted off to sleep.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I've been captivated by Mark's talking, actually. Ah. I think it's a great little framework.
Thank you.
But I was curious about your selection of your choice of avatar/gravatar. I think that's fantastic, too.
That's Jerry Statler, is it not?
It is Statler, yeah. I don't photograph well, and I don't have any photographs of me that I'm happy to put up.
That's got to be rough if you've chosen the Statler picture over here.
Well, then the thing was, it was I originally chose it as my gravatar icon, so it was what was going to show up in comments, and I thought, well, I'm coming along and just someone's put in all this hard work and I'm just shouting from the side, so I thought it was quite appropriate. And then when I got onto Twitter and I needed to choose a picture for Twitter, it was kind of the same thing. And people who know me personally would say, yeah, he sits on the side and shouts abusive things that he thinks are funny. Yeah, it is. It's quite appropriate. It's taken on a life of its own now, though. If you do a Google image search for Mark Rendell, the front page is half full of Statler.
So now where's Waldorf?
I don't know. I'm tall and thin, so I'm kind of more the Statler guy. If someone wants to come along and beat my Waldorf, then that would be awesome. But you can get a kind of a really nice kind of $50 or $60 full latex mask of Statler, which I need to get at some point. As I'm doing more presentations and going to conferences, I'm turning up and people haven't got the faintest idea who I am. But I think if I turn, wear a Statler mask, then people go, oh, it's Mark Rendell.
Or at least a t-shirt, right?
Yeah, probably the t-shirt's a slightly...
Well, maybe a little simpler, but no.
You know, I'm starting to get out there on the speaker circuit now. So
well, it's not half as awkward as Kevin having to strike the kung fu pose. So.
yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, we should wrap up here. Do you have anything you'd like to promote anywhere you're speaking soon? I know DDD just went down. Is there anything else coming up?
DDD just went down. I am in the there's an awesome thing happening in the second half of the year where apparently I'm going to be doing a two-hander presentation with John Skeet, which we set up at the weekend. Next week in London at Skills Matter, I'm talking at Cloud Evening. That's Tuesday the 15th. And then the week after that, I'm talking at Cambridge Next Gen User Group. So there you go. There's a couple of plugs. And that's the next gen is on Tuesday the 22nd. But I'm all over the place. I will be coming to a user group near you. And if people want to pay for my plane ticket, then hopefully I'll be over in the States going to some things over there soon as well. But yeah.
Great.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been really fun.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, it's obviously Simple Data was great, but then the tie-in, I didn't realize that you were involved with Owen and Crack and that's and Fix now, and so that's a nice, you know, after having just talked to Seb about Open Rasta. Very cool.
Yeah.
So great. Okay. Well, thanks a bunch, and we'll catch you all next time on Herding Code, and goodbye.